The lights go to red now. The Grand Prix of the Czech Republic is underway.
Not a great start from Cal Crutchlow from the front row of the grid. Very good from Danny Pedrosa, but it's Jorge Lorenzo gets the Subaru off the best of the rest. And look out for Valentino Rossi, right through on the inside.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 334 for Wednesday to the 29th of August, 2012. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm in the Bay Area, California, San Francisco, and with me is Jim Race, a little bit further north of me. How you doing, Jim? Ooh.
I'm fine.
You must be doing fine.
How you doing, Jules? Kind of a crazy weekend. One of those busy weekends. In fact, it's so much that while we're going to talk about a bunch of the racing, one of the things that I really haven't been able to do is actually focus on what was going on at Cadwell, because that was kind of a crazy weekend. So we're going to kind of bypass BSB this weekend because neither of us have had the time to focus on it. So fair warning, those of you Brits out there that are going, oh, or they're going, oh shit, well, they don't know anything about BSB anyway.
Exactly.
Fair apologies, but we haven't forgotten. I heard it was a bit of an ice fest at certain points, but there's lots of talk about with MotoGP and World Superbike. And not only that, Jules, but listener email, it got crazy this week.
Yeah, we had, and of course, we'll start with Errata, because even though we stuck this in the show notes last week, it does need to be mentioned that last week we actually talked about Casey Stoner's foot that he hurt at Indianapolis being his left foot, but it was actually his right foot. So, which makes a big difference because the left foot's the one used for shifting. I don't think he would have been able to last as long as he had.
So we put Casey's foot in our mouth.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. We forgot to include a link last week also to the LCR magazine that Lucio Cicinello talked about in your interview. So we'll have that in this week's notes. Make sure you go check it out. It's an extremely cool magazine. You may want to turn down the volume before you go there, of course.
Although the music is cool.
It's very cool. It's very cool, but in case you're like in an open office environment or something like that, you might be taken by surprise.
And I'm a little scared in that interview that Lucio did. He said, we have something special for you, Jim. So I may appear in a future issue of that. I'm not certain. We'll have to see.
That'd be fun. And finally, I cannot believe we forgot to mention the incredibly awesome meetup that we had at Indy. We got so kind of sidetracked with all the stuff that went on at Indy, we forgot to talk about, you know, meeting the Motopod listeners, which was awesome.
Yeah, you know? It was, in a way, it was a beautiful day, obviously on Saturday, the Yard Bricks behind the Pagoda on the infield side. Yep. I was like that. And it was cool because there were a whole bunch of vintage bikes they had lined up for all 3 days there kind of alongside. And mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jules, but it was a lot more crowded out there than it has been in past years. And it might have been because of the bikes.
The entire infield actually was really buzzing. They did a really good job with the marketplace, with the vendor area, with the concerts that were constantly going on. So as a result, I mean, I don't know if you noticed it, because I don't know if you ventured that way, but obviously I was photographing along the straight. They actually closed down a lot of the grandstands completely.
Right.
So people were sitting basically in E and F, and then like all the way down to J was closed.
Right.
So that basically along the straight was pretty much closed. So I think the reason for that is because they wanted to get the people more into the infield where they could, you know, check out that part of the you know, get more business for the vendors, obviously, but also just
get them into the experience. Before we get too far, let's talk about the meetup, because the meetup was fun. We had on and off a whole bunch of people shifting, and I wouldn't even venture a guess to how many we had. It was probably it was a number. We did have Dr. Martin Raines come down with us. He was a special guest to join us. And in that same vein, I brought down the t-shirt that I intended to give away, or we intended to give away for the show.
At Laguna,
that I forgot. A special one-off on the front was an alien head, and on the rear was a just an alien script, if you will. what would an alien do on a CRT? And so Dr. Martin Raines was kind enough to come up with a question. And Jules, remind me what the question was.
It was the American writer.
Last American writer to...
Oh, I don't know.
It was definitely an American thing.
Yeah. Anyway. You know what? The guy you're about to mention knows the question.
Very true. Although it was funny because it was definitely an American writer, because what happened as soon as we asked the question, or Dr. Raines asked the question, was that everybody started yelling out American writer names. that I remember. And the gentleman that...
The answer was Robert Sr., but I don't know what the question was.
The gentleman that won it happened to be holding it for me, which I thought was funny. Pretty sure that was Jim McDowell, Jules.
Yeah, RGV writer.
Yep. So congratulations to him. He's got a very cool one-off. There's only one of those that exists in the world at this moment. maybe for the best. I'm curious, Jim, have you worn it?
How many WTFs did you get?
Yeah, exactly. It was a pretty cool shirt. I kind of wish that I'd printed up two at least so I could have a spare. But
it's not as exclusive. You know, that's how artists piss off collectors. You know?
Oh, by keeping one.
Here's
for themselves.
Here's 10 limited prints. Oh, and I'm going to make 100 more.
Oh, I mean, two, not so bad. You know.
All right. Anyway, it was great. Seeing everybody, seeing some familiar faces, seeing a lot of new faces, and. I know that a lot of people came in from very far away. John Hart rode from Florida, for example. We saw some familiar faces that came from California. So
right.
That sure. Drove from California, I mean.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. All right. So, it was great.
And I think one thing that's cool is that there were at least one or two people there that had been there for...
Since 2008.
Yeah, since 2008.
Yeah, the first one. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Very cool. All right. Listener feedback. It's been a busy week, burning up emails, burning up Facebook, wherever you guys chat with us. It's fair fodder unless you say otherwise. yep. And we, these ones have come in basically since the last show. And frankly, they're awesome. Some of them, are long, and we totally love that. There is one little excerpt here that came in this evening, Jules, that I'm just going to read out loud and leave it at that, because it kind of relates to something we talked about last week. But are you smiling, Jules, or are you cringing?
I'm both.
This came from a listener that writes into us all the time. He says, give Stoner a dildo with wheels and a 47cc engine, and he'll probably lap it faster than Petrucci can get that IOTA bike around.
Brilliant. Thank you, mystery writer.
Mystery writer, yes. I thought it was funny. The rest of the email was hilarious, too. It probably actually gets a bit more risque, but it was a classic.
We'll probably read it next week. But
I think we may.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're gonna skip it for now.
But yeah, part of the reason we didn't is because we've got a million. Jules, you want to? Sam Dixon wrote it, and why don't you read out through that, sir?
Yeah, so he says, I just want to throw out something. This is actually, I think he posted on Facebook, so it was discussed a little bit on Facebook. I just want to throw out something out there regarding the much discussed Ducati issue. Instead of thinking about this project as the Ducati problems, let's remember how ridiculously good the others, especially the M1, have been. Since 2007, Ducati's last world championship, the M1 has won all but one world championship. And since 2004, the M1 has only been beaten three times, in 2006, 2007, and 2011. And let's not forget that it's pretty much in the bag for this year. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that.
Yep.
Obviously, neither did Sam, because this was written before this last weekend. The M1 is a fascinating, amazing machine that deserves its credit. The Crossplane i4 is an amazing feat of engineering. The R1 with the same engine has been quite good also. My point is this. Let's not dwell so much on the duck being bad, but how good the others have been. And I think this is great.
I thought we addressed that last week. Did we not in the show?
This particular comment?
No, but that particular point.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But it does need to be restated as,
sure.
as specifically as that. Is that, yeah. It's the M1 has been amazing. And the Honda is an amazing machine as well. I mean, they the things that they're doing with the gearbox and the clutch there are, you know, hopefully someday will trickle down to us, because it just sounds amazing.
Here's a different way to make that point, Jules. And this might help some of the folks that are kind of new to the sport. Cause I know there are some of you listening out there. We actually got an email that we'll talk about later. Probably the most amazing thing about MotoGP, especially as it relates to people that ride street bikes, is that in MotoGP, the technology, if you're a team and you're a manufacturer, you cannot stand still. And so the amount of changes and reintegration and modifications that are made to the bikes, on a weekly basis, you know, if you have a world championship bike right now, Jules, and you think it's the best bike in the world, and we've actually seen that this year, and you say, well, I'll just use that bike next year, you're not going to win. Odds right. are you're not going to win.
Right.
Because the other guys are going to go, well, watch this.
Well, it's such a step. We now know what we faced.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, we got to crank it up. You know, this did actually work in the 500cc era, because remember Doohan was given a new bike in 2006, I believe, and said,
nope,
no freaking way am I riding that thing, giving my 2005, actually I think it was 97. He had already won one championship or two championships. And so he had the clout to say, nah, I'm riding my 1996 biker, and that's that.
But I mean, even in that situation, Jules, what they would have done was taken the few good things that worked on the new bike.
Agreed. Agreed. But they gave him a brand new design.
Yeah.
Lots of millions of dollars, you know, poured into this thing. And, you know, it was their concentration for designing the next level of the machine. So I think that would not fly anymore. That would just basically, you'd get mired.
Yeah. You know? And so the bottom line is that,
And yet you have to say that one thing about technology, you know, you have that all these Moore's laws and all that kind of stuff, yet there is certain kind of logarithmic kind of progression. And, you know, it takes more and more money to get less and less actual performance. So you could see certain things started to level out, you know, for example, until Bridgestone provides a much different, more sticky, some major leap in tire technology, you know, you won't be able to exceed certain lean angles by messing with the suspensions. To some degree, yes, but it'll be much less than what we did when we went from, you know, the 990 to the 800, for example.
Well, there's a secondary one, which is probably, in a way, even more, which is aero. And that's physics and unconquerable. You can only push a motorcycle through the air with the frontal area that they have to do. And that also, or that's a square as you go up by a certain amount. And essentially what happens is, no matter how much power you have, since motorcycles don't have effective downforce, you know, these guys at the fastest tracks, Mugello, I mean, everywhere where they're doing, you know, the same thing at Indy, you know, 200 miles an hour on a straight, the entire way down the straight.
217.
Yeah. The rear tire is spinning.
Yeah. It's the biggest problem actually with longevity of the tires. It's not the, you know, cornering, backing it in or anything like that. It's just going down the straight.
So that is kind of, there's definitely a finite limit there. Do they broach a little bit more every year? But I mean, if we look back to the highest top speed that we've seen out of a MotoGP bike, I think we go back to 2004, was it? With, I want to say.
We've hit higher speed limits this year, I believe, at Mugello than ever before.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
Dr. Reins.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we 217 is the fastest that bike has circulated on the Mugello straight. Maybe there's some other place where that's not the case, but yeah, if somebody knows the answer to that, I'd be curious to hear.
But the top speeds have not gone up as fast as over the years
As lap times.
As lap times have dropped.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for the first year in 800s, the top speeds dropped, but the lap times increased on some circuits. Yeah. So, you know, very good point, Sam. And I think, but still, doing a championship at factory has to, you know, get off their asses and start winning some races.
Well, let's take the other side to that. It's not like Ducati has sat on, you know, their butts not doing anything. They made a shitload of changes last year. But as Nikki said, actually, in a very recent interview, maybe too many. And so they made a lot of changes. They just haven't been to the benefit of their riders. So that's the other thing.
He did say this year that it's the best Ducati he's ridden, and he has a lot more experience on it than Rossi, as he pointed out at the Riders for Health thing. 4 years on the bike, and he says this is by far the best motor. Obviously there's progress, but the point is that, like, that doesn't let Ducati off the hook for the fact that they didn't really develop in 2010. And now they're effectively behind.
They're playing catch up.
They're constantly playing catch up, and they're probably not attacking the areas where they really need to attack. It's like there's a piece of spaghetti code that they just don't want to touch. You know, again, we're getting into nerdy programming talk, but that's the closest.
No pun intended, Red Jules.
Yeah, spaghetti. We didn't. That's a total deja vu. We've said this exact thing before.
We probably
including the no pun intended. All right. Anyway, let's move on.
All right. Sheldon Gooby. I just wanted to say that name. this was from Facebook. Yep. He said, "As long as there is a faster option on track, CRT." And this is his opinion. His opinion piece. All of them are, of course. Faster option on track. CRT will never be interesting other than to see who is going to be the top CRT for the weekend. While this past weekend, speaking of obviously this past weekend, was a great race. You only need two bikes to make a race. Overall, MotoGP has lost its identity this season with the introduction of this lower tiered bike on track. I think Dorna has really messed up MotoGP ever since the switch to 800s. It was the start of the downfall of GP. Not the downfall with respect to the entertainment value, but the downfall with respect to the identity of the brand and idea of a true prototype. The 800 era became the era of electronics, where the true beast of a prototype was tamed by a computer and not the wrist of the rider. It eventually caused the loss of two factory teams, and because of this, the CRT concept was born to help fill the grid. I do not see a full CRT grid to be something appealing to me in any way. And then the other option of it restricting the bikes by ECU and rev limits, to me, goes even further to tame the prototype beast. In the wild, it's survival of the fittest. And maybe with today's economy, we're witnessing the death of GP, as sad as it is to say. I've not seen an alternative put forward that does anything to further the prototype concept, but simply hinder the prototype potential so the guys at the back can play catch-up. Do you think that if there was no 800 era, that we would be in the same position today with respect to grid size? I feel the 990s could have had a much longer life cycle than they were allowed to live.
I have to say that, first of all, we need to correct this every time this happens, because I used to make the same mistake also. I used to say Dorna this, Dorna that.
Yeah.
Dorna has absolutely no control over this decision to go to the 800s was absolutely MSMA request. Which is Honda, Yamaha, Ducati, Suzuki at the time, and
even Kawasaki,
right? So it's the manufacturer's request, and it was played as a
safety
issue, and now we're talking about, you know, money issues. Yeah, I'm starting to see how the game is played. Basically, the idea is that. If you want to get really cynical,
I know where you're going.
The engineering teams, the R&D teams say, well, you know, here are the rules. We have to make a completely new thing. Give us a huge freaking budget, you know?
Well, there's a secondary part is that this current formula isn't working that well for us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was just going to get to that. Honda saying, well, we haven't won a championship in a few years. Let's really shake things up. We've got the clout to push the MSMA around. We know that Honda has done that in the past. Now, as to the other questions, what would have happened if the 990s? I do agree that we probably would have had more factories. I think that the switch to 800s really hurt, like Suzuki, for example. I think they sunk a lot of money into the 990s. We're about to get really excellent, and the change started happening, right?
Well, yeah, I think, let me further your point.
But okay, just go ahead. Go ahead.
Is that what it did, that change, the 800 change, made those factories go, the factories that were on the brink go, well, screw this, because I don't want to live with an inconsistent set of rules. And so all the money that they sunk into that, they had to throw it away, because and they had to respend once again. That's why I'm saying I'm furthering your point, because I think that's where you might have been going.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think that the electronics would have come in anyway, because there was no way that the electronics were already entering street bikes, actually much before they hit the GB prototypes, because they didn't need to. They weren't needed yet.
Well, the electronics were coming in before we even went to four strokes.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, fuel injection, all that kind of stuff, of course. But I'm talking about like what we refer to as traction control nowadays.
Right.
Some teams were experimenting with it in 2001, I think, 2002. Mm-hmm. But in general, it was still, hand to the wheel kind of thing. But they would have definitely, because the thing is, there's only so much efficiency you can get out of a 990 engine. And so they would start reaching some limits, and somebody would go, if we can get this thing going through corners faster, but how do we do that? Well, we can start controlling wheel spin, all that kind of stuff. The processor fast enough, all that, the sensors are tiny enough. So we would have gone in that direction anyway. Now, I do think that we could have probably strung along some of these guys who were not, because it wasn't as big of a change. It was a gradual thing. It would have been a slow development, instead of like, oh, here, by the way, cut off a cylinder off the five cylinder bikes, and the rest of you guys, you're totally screwed. Why don't we read another email from listener Andy Pilbeam, who is very very new to the sport, and he writes, and this is he's it's a total, it's a perfect counterpoint to what Shelby was writing about.
He writes,
the main reason for writing in is about discussions about CRT bikes. As mentioned, I have only just got into biking, so my experience may be slightly blinkered, but here's my view. I started watching all of the MotoGPs last year and was a bit confused as to why it was such a small grid with noticeable bike manufacturers not there, or only with one bike. Suzuki, he rides the GSXR, and Kawasaki, especially as they both have teams in Superbikes and BSB. I like that fact that the CRT teams, there is a bigger grid, and I wonder why so many people seem to be against it or so worried about it. Surely it is better to have more bikes on the grid, even if they aren't all battling for the podium. You only have to look at other sports, Formula One in particular. Caterham, Sauber, Toro Rosso, for example, aren't really going to get on the podium, but Bernie would be up in arms if there was only Ferrari, Red Bull, Lotus, and McLaren on the grid. The same with football, soccer, quote, quote. You need Norwich, Southampton, and Wigan in the top divisions, along with Man City, Chelsea, and Arsenal. And he put Arsenal in capital letters. I have a feeling he may be an Arsenal fan.
I think so.
My opinion is that you need the other teams there competing. This provides more exposure, more advertising, more competition, and more for the spectators to watch. It would be very boring if there was only Honda, Yamaha, and Ducati there, which is the way it was going last year. I always look out for James Ellison this year, and some of the battles Paul and RDP had, I think he means Alesh Espargaró, yep, and RDP have had this year, have been great. I just hope the TV starts to make an interest in those battles. So what if some of the bikes are 2 or 3 seconds a lap slower? Look at Formula One again. Quite a few cars are that much slower than the Red Bulls or Ferraris. It brings drivers through and creates more excitement. Keep them there. Developments will come. It will get closer, but drop them. Keep the grip numbers up, get more people watching and more people riding, speaking from experience.
Exclamation point.
So it's a great counterpoint, and I think that there's one specific thing that I think would very much help this, is if we did see more of the CRT battles.
Yeah.
You know, if there was a way to see it. Because here's the problem. Even when you're going to the racetrack, I can't think of any track where you don't get this, where you go, where there's a giant jumbotron right next to your grandstand.
It's going to be, yeah, it'll be focused on the guys at the front.
Yeah. And so the thing is, you end up watching the front guys go by, and then you look up at the jumbo, and you're still watching the front guys. You know, you don't get to see those battles even there, unless something crazy happens, like one of them crashes right in front of you.
I would think, Jules, that probably you get, because of the way that you shoot, you being the staff photographer, probably see more of the CRT battles than just about anybody, because I know that when I'm at a race, I'm always trying to see what's going on kind of globally through the field, but I'm also always very curious about what's going on up front, because that's going to dictate kind of what I do immediately post-race.
That's right.
And so I know that even I have a tendency to not focus. Well, there's no way to do it, because even with the feed in the media center or through the garages, you really don't get to see that much of the CRT, because it's mostly the same stuff that's going on TV. I do want to say, though, Andy, thank you for writing in, because you say getting blinkered. I think we have a tendency to do the same thing, because we get so wrapped up in the bits, bobs, and details of what goes on in racing that we forget that there are people out there that are new to the sport. And you sound like you've dived in feet and head first. And so I really appreciate somebody writing in and kind of humbling us a bit to remind us that our viewpoint of what's going on isn't necessarily that's shared by the new fans. There are people out there that the formula is working with.
Just new fans. There's a lot of fans who've been around for a long time that are super excited about the larger grids and the fact that there's more riders.
Well, I think, as I've learned, Jules, that it's not popular to be up on CRTs. I mean, and a big part of why that is because some of the guys that are on CRTs, notably Colin and, you know, some of the other guys, they don't necessarily want to be there. That's a proven fact. We know that. But I agree with Andy in that, to some extent, I don't know what the exact right idea, and then we go back up to the prior email, is to make things right. But it's nice to know that what is happening is working for some of the fans that are out there. So
yep.
there are two sides to every story. And I think it's cool to be able to hear the other one, because we don't hear it often enough. We get you hardcore guys, you write in like 20-1 to emails to this. So
yeah that's very true.
I totally love it. Andy, you get a Motopod gold star, dude. Thanks.
Yeah, it'll be in the mail.
Yeah, well, you never know. Send us your mailing address, and we'll get out a sticker or something to you.
Cool. I mean, before Indy, I was, even before the race, I was already starting to talk it's an artificial way to fill a grid. It's only interesting at the start of the race and on the final tally sheet, but both Indy and Brunel kind of changed my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I'm starting to warm up, just like I had a really tough time warming up to the 800s at first. And then suddenly it was like, God damn it, this is good racing. You know?
Yeah.
It's a good, yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, it was difficult to, Moto2 is a perfect example. Moto2 year one, it was great racing, but it was tough to get used to because it was random and kind of nutty. And
I like that.
And then we realized that nuttiness was awesome. So there's a lot of experiments going on. I think I used that term when we talked to Dr. Martin Raines, and I still feel like we basically are experiment. We have three different experiments running right now with Moto 3, Moto 2, and the CRTs. So, you know, we'll see how they turn out.
I think the governing bodies were emboldened by the success of Moto 2.
Yes.
And because there were a lot of people that were naysaying before that, we were initially in that group. Because we like, I think almost everybody out there wanted to have a choice of engines for the bikes. And we still do, frankly, now.
Yes, we do. Yeah. But in the meantime, there's some great racing.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll have to see. Tons more email here.
I'm going to scroll back up. I'm going to say, so there was a photo I had on, when I posted the photos from India on Flickr, observant user, Talon the Hunter is his username on Flickr, and I don't know what his real name is, but he pointed out that the GP Tech bike at Indy were running steel brakes the entire time. And I asked you about it, and you were like, well, duh. And explain, really? Please.
They're super fucking expensive.
Yep.
To the point where it might have doubled the cost of what they're talking about. I'm not sure how Attack handled that, whether they had some very serious sponsorship, but those things are not cheap. The actual costs, I can't remember what it is, like 2K plus per caliper, 6 to 8K per rotor. And you may go through several of those in a weekend, all dependent upon if you've got the right temperature range, because you have to have a few.
The pads,
pads, the whole nine yards. And
then you have to also make sure that the entire bike is set up to deal with that, with the crazy power of those things. So
and that the rider is prepared to deal with it.
Yes.
Does it make a difference? Yes.
You know, a track like Indy, which has a lot of, you know, fast, slow.
Yeah.
I could see him losing a second of a lap with that. But is it worth it? He made the QP.
Yeah, sure.
He had a race, and I think they, as Jeff said in the interview, they accomplished all the goals that they wanted to accomplish.
And it sounds like they're going to move forward. So, fact, I've heard more about that. They are going to try and get out for another wild card round this year. So, you heard it here first or secondarily, unless you're on the same places that I'm at. But it sounds like GP Tech is going to try and get another shot at a wild card this year, which I think is great. Yeah, I think it's awesome. I'll keep going here. I want to read the Johnny piece. I love it.
Okay.
And then we'll pop back and we'll move around. Johnny. Here's Johnny, writes in this brilliant piece. Considering the and this is a bit of prose, so I want to make sure that I get it proper. Considering the financial lagoons Ducati fans have swam through with their company, and the death knell of an inline four is the last thing we want to hear. Rossi and Hayden are complaining more about the deck's handling than the power plant. Granted, the engine configuration may contribute to this. Looking at the GP manufacturer standings from last year, the inline four didn't fix Suzuki or Team Green. I love this part here. I think the only race they're in is Jim. Talk about not giving up the ghost. Thank you very much, Johnny. Letting the bird fly to GP would be a better alternative for Ducati, in my humble opinion. Ducati's engine is still soaring in Superbike, Superstock, as well as in smaller ponds like Flat Track and Pikes Peak to prove its virility. Great choice of words. All that without having to swim in a self-made puddle like Jules XR 1200. Well, he goes on. I like the XR races as well, but one of us had to drive the bus. So we need good photography. and this is a big what if. The sitting deck in GP is a distraction they need to derive real innovations in other technologies, long shots like Moto Zero, or that would be in line with Ducati and Audi for that matter. It's taken 30 years for me to release BMW from my bowels. That was great. To look at what was created after the Verboten Boxer, Os America. If I hear any more about an inline Ducati, I'm going to fly over to the Europe and have Martin deafen me with the Isle of Man Norton. And he finishes off by saying, back to making my moonshine.
Woo-hoo. All right.
You know, I'm really wondering, Jules, if that isn't Critter. It could be. Johnny, that was good. I'm almost tempted to print that somewhere. It's an awesome piece. I don't have any replies for that.
Well, I mean, the main thing is I think what we kind of touched on last show, which is stick, you know, the Ducati soul it will be compromised.
It's already compromised.
It is compromised because they're not winning. but it'll be compromised. I mean, there's a lot of people that feel it will be compromised by a drastic change in the engine configuration. But as we discussed also last week, I think that it would be that nobody would care if they started winning races.
Well, you're right. We talked about that. You know, I didn't make it at Indy to Ducati Island. I don't know if you made it in.
Oh yeah.
Atmosphere just normal.
You know, I wasn't there long enough, but I went to the Laguna one, and that was the usual. I mean, you know, the Ducatisti, they love their bikes. There was many there at both Laguna and Indy. All right, moving on. Rogerio Sabino writes in, can you guys explain to me what are the benefits of being rider number one on a factory ride? This is a very good question. Because I thought that the difference was when the points were at stake. At the final race of the championship, the factory would ask rider number two step down in favor of rider number one, assuming rider number one was actually leading the championship. I never thought that the hardware or parts were different in the same factory bikes. But for sure, Spies doesn't have the same bike as Lorenzo. Because how is it possible that with the same factory bike, Spies has a broken frame, a broken swing arm, a blown engine, etc.? And the only problem with Lorenzo was to be taken out by Bautista. Is Valentino getting the same M1 as Lorenzo for 2013, or will he get that piece of scrap and bed parts that poor Spies got for 2012? Not taking anything away from Jorge. I am a huge Rossi fan, but I also have a lot of respect for every MotoGP rider. They are simply gods. But I smell a huge gap of treatment of Yamaha between their two factory riders, and I don't like it, present or future. So this is a great question because it came up a lot when we were in Indy during the various conferences. A lot of journalists were asking both Rossi and Jorge about how they feel about, you know, the thing. And I think that the Spies comparison is a little bit unfair because I think that Honda has definitely done this kind of thing before. Usually what happens is one rider becomes kind of like a test bed for new parts. They may receive the new parts sooner, but it's not because they are the number one rider. It's more like because they're the guinea pig. And that was certainly the case with Alex Barros, for example, in 2004. Well, it was certainly the case with Mickey Hayden in 2006, and he won the championship anyway.
Well, and even in 2007, frankly, which became really weird after having won the championship.
that's very true. That is very, very true.
Yeah.
So some teams do that. I actually think that the Yamaha is a bad example of that because they seem to be even generous to their satellite teams in a way that other manufacturers are not.
Well, let me point something out for Rogerio that I think is key. Regardless of what kit, parts and bits and things like that, hardware as you speak of, let's say I give the exact same parts to rider A and rider B, or rider 1 and rider 2. Each of those riders has a different crew. And how those bikes are put together and how they're prepared prior to practice and racing is going to be functionally different based on the human factor of the people that are putting it together. So for the most part,
you're saying even if you start with a baseline of exactly the same bits and bobs, as you like to say,
right?
The crews still are a very different variable, and they're a massively important variable.
Exactly. Well, yeah, absolutely. It's a triangle. It's rider, hardware, crew. It's like the kitten triangle. that's a very obscure reference, but that's not to say that two-part A's, swing arm A and swing arm A, being absolutely identical, even the riders are different, and the stresses that they put the bike under.
Go ahead. Part A and part A,
yeah,
being you know,
identical,
identical. They're one of parts. You have to understand these are prototype bikes. They're one of parts, which means there can be a manufacturing defect. It's not like there's an assembly line,
right?
Yeah, you know, thing where they figured out exactly how to do it. These very often, if you look at the parts closely, they're milled and welded
by hand.
By hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But my point being, Joel, is that if you have two parts that are as near identical as you can get through human manufacturing,
yeah,
you could swap them back and forth and it wouldn't matter. One rider may put different, or not may, will put different stresses on that part than another rider will.
And then the crew's going to make different adjustments for them, and which right. means the part is going to react with the rest of the bike in a different way.
Exactly. And so, are there parts that are substandard? I'm not sure I ever believed that at the height of the sport that we're talking about, a factory team. There are a lot of people looking to lay blame somewhere. I'm not sure where the blame needs to be laid, because it's quite possible, and there has been shit luck for riders in the past that if you look at, because part of his point was Ben's had shit luck, that he's had an over concentration of it this year. And there's been people talking silly conspiracy theories. I doubt that. So
the thing is, whenever a conspiracy arises, you have to think about
what the motivation is.
Who would benefit, and two, how many people would have to be involved for it to be kept a secret, right? And in this case, who the hell is going to benefit from Ben Spee's engine blowing up or
Valentino
whatever?
Rossi?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's actually Espoleta that's pulling the strings here.
Right, yeah,
no,
true.
But the thing is that there's way too many people that would be negatively affected by I mean, think about how this makes Yamaha look.
Right.
They can barely keep one factory bike running, you know? It blew up when it tipped over when Bautista took out Jorge, right? So I think that Yamaha really truly historically when they have a number one, number two rider, it's more like, I think in some teams, a rider will be designated as the guy who gets to choose kind of the direction that the development is going to go in when they have this, their one or two annual discussions with the riders, with engineers coming, flying in, let's say from Japan, meeting together with the riders. In some cases, it iterates more often, but sometimes it's just a few times a year, and even then it's almost procedural, or not procedural, but I don't know. The Japanese have a very strange approach to a lot of these things, because there's still a lot of the honor kind of, there's a protocol. That's what I meant to say. There's a protocol.
Although it seems to be maybe not foundationally different, but fundamentally different between, let's say, Honda and Yamaha.
Oh, yeah. No, exactly. And I think that Yamaha, that's why I was saying Yamaha is historically has treated the bikes, I mean, the riders, maybe as, let's say Rossi and Checa when they were on the same team. Rossi being the number one rider, but the bikes were the same. Maybe they were listening to Rossi more as to which direction they needed to take the development in, which maybe did not benefit Checa so much because he has a different riding style, and so on. So now that Jorge has been promised this number one spot, I have no idea what that means, because Jorge won't mind if Valentino Rossi makes the bike better, if Rossi has some good ideas, and certainly Rossi, if he can adapt himself to where the M1 is now and be competitive, he's not going to complain about Jorge having a say because obviously he's been winning races on it. So I think it's, in this particular case, it's kind of a moot point. But there are definitely teams where it does matter. Caparossi was complaining a lot about in 2007 that he, because he was number one since 2003, he was complaining about that, and that actually led to him leaving the team. Because Stoner became the number one rider. And I don't know what that exactly meant inside the squad, but it definitely upset Caparossi.
Well, I think there's also a secondary part of it, which I think is undeniable, is there's ego.
Yes, of course. You want to be called number one, you know?
Yeah, I mean, even if you're getting the same bits and bobs, you may not be getting the same personnel and attention. You know, we've certainly seen personnel issues within the same teams before, no doubt. And that mix is usually, depending upon your level of influence as a rider, is a lot of that's influenced by the team itself, which person goes where. So, yeah. We are going on, Jules, I think.
Okay, these last two emails have to do with the race at Brno, which we will talk about more, obviously, later. Nick Codling writes in, how good was that last lap? Proper racing at last. It was like Rossi, Lorenzo, Catalunya, 09, almost. It was really classic stuff. Really enjoyed it. Shame we had to wait all race for it, but it was refreshing nonetheless. What this confirms for us is, one, this is what it'll be like without Stoner. And two, Pedrosa has finally started to ride like a champion, like a proper hard racer. Not just pulling a lead and maintaining, but properly taking the fight to Lorenzo, being aggressive and getting stuck in. Nice one, Danny.
Yep.
As Beth Andrews said on Twitter, all we need now is for Danny to smile a bit more. Come on, fella, you get paid to travel the world and race motorcycles for a living. You just want to race and beat your biggest rival. Smile more. And of course, as a Brit, big whoop whoop for Cal on the podium. At last. This is kind of like a spoilers email. Anyway, who thought he'd fade and get taken by Dovi? Come on, admit it. Who thought the picture would cut back to him fishing the bike out of the gravel? Maybe. Well, I'm glad it finally happened. The guy is gutsy, he works hard, and he's a character that MotoGP needs. So it's great to see him do well, finally. I really hope it's not a one-off. And let's be honest, on the Tectoire bike, that's really about as good as a result as you could have expected. But really, it's a privateer win, kind of. Must have been a really long race for Cal, but he was glad to get it across the line. Really hoping Danny's form continues. We get to see a proper fight. Would hate to see this championship settled by injury. It's been affected by that already with Stoner, and Danny's no stranger to having his title aspirations dashed through injury. Fingers crossed, eh? Yes. Fingers are definitely crossed for that one.
Danny does smile now.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you got to go check out some of the photos I took at Indy, especially... came in the conferences and just, you know, participating. Actually, just, you know, watch after the flag he was on after, I think, in the Mugello show. And
well, in Laguna, too, he was laughing.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, I mean, you know, yeah, we're making it sound like, oh, my God, the guy's laughing. I think it really just comes down to the fact that this is the only season since, I believe, his first 250 crown
that he's not
where he hasn't been hurt.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the guy was, I remember that interview with him before the 2009 season, I think, where, I mean, you could see even sitting, he was in pain. He was so uncomfortable. He wasn't not smiling because he doesn't know how to smile. It's because he was just in pain, you know, all the time. Anyway, the other point I wanted to address here was when you said shame, we had to wait all race for it, because I don't really think it was waiting, but we'll get into that when we cover the race itself. And of course, yeah, everybody was very happy for Cal. And then finally, William Butch Erwin shared some of his some new. He's becoming our Charlie Cox expert. So thanks for that, William. He found two new good ones from the Brno BBC broadcast, and these are them. That bike's got more laps on it than a pizza delivery bike.
That could have been way more coxism. I have to say that was pretty mild when I saw that. I'm like, oh, I want to start making them up for Charlie.
And the second one is, he's clinging on like a limpet to a rock, that Danny Pedrosa.
I think what I need to do.
So what's a limpet?
A limpet is a, it's like a mollusk.
Like a barnacle.
Yeah, like a barnacle.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah, I think for the coxisms, I need to make sure that I just run my recorder regardless on Friday or Saturday night when we run into the gin at the bar.
Oh, man.
Speaking of which, we ran into a lot of people in the bars. Well, anyway. What else we got, Jules? Have we made it through yet? No, there's one more, I think, somewhere.
We're done with emails. Okay. And thank you for everybody for writing in, posting on Facebook. I'm sorry we don't get to all of them.
But damn, just,
sometimes we grab a bunch. But oh man, we're already an hour into the show. All right.
To finish off the spoilers, Jules.
Yes.
The other bit, the quote from Cal from the weekend. We can leave Brno really happy because it has been a great weekend. I signed a new contract with the Monster Yamaha Tech 3's team. Got my best grid position, scored my first ever MotoGP podium, and then set the fastest time at the test today. Well, there's your Uber spoiler, isn't it? Yeah. Jules is like, I'm cutting that out.
No, you're not.
All right.
Okay, so obviously Cal did sign with Tech 3. It was announced on Saturday, I believe, before QP. And, I think it was... And that's before the first practice session started.
I think it was late Thursday.
Yeah. That's usually when that kind of stuff happens. And he did do well in the test. We'll probably cover the test later on. We'll see.
Yeah.
All right. So got to talk about Moto 3, Moto 2, Moto GP. They were all three. So first of all, Eastern Europe, thumbs up.
Yeah.
Delivered this weekend. All the racing, actually, with this exception of World Super Sports. Extremely interesting stuff. Moto 3, we started off with a qualifying that was iffy weather, but not too bad. Actually, for Brno, we had a lot of dangerous looking radar, but it never really got that bad until Saturday night, where all the kind of rubber got rained off. But for qualifying in Moto 3, it was Vinales on the front, on the pole, and with Cortese next to him, of course. Whenever Vinales does anything, Cortese's right there. And Zulfami Khairuddin, I think this is his first front row start this year. I'm not positive on that one. And Antonelli, who's been kind of hot and cold, on the second row with Luis Salom, and Hector Fabel, who we have not heard much from this year. This is actually one of his better starts as well. And it's actually one guy who definitely did not, along with Nico Tirol, I guess, they did not merge well into Moto 3. And he's not going to be in Moto 3 next year because he can't, because unless they change the rule for the age, because he's 28, and 28 is the cutoff age.
Graduation,
yeah. And then we had Jakob Kornfeld on the third row, the Czech rider. So he was hoping to do well in the race. The race itself was a really weird because, like I said, it rained overnight and it was still wet in the morning. I think that actually was a wet warm up.
I believe it was.
And it was just the track really just started to dry out, and it was a little bit similar to when we had the superbikes there during the first race, where everybody was kind of like picking different lines because some riders were on wet, some riders were on dries, and the way that track dries, because it's a very wide track, and you know, at the higher elevations, it dries up pretty much across the entire track. When you get down into the stadium section, as they call it, you can get little rivers running through, and or a dry path forming that's very narrow, and so all the riders are kind of forced to go into that particular section. But only one rider, in particular, was on wets, and that was Efren Vasquez. I think there were a bunch of guys starting off at the back that also were on wets. And so in the beginning, he really had a huge advantage, came passed at least six or seven riders, took to the front, had a 3-second lead, and I'm sure was, you know, crossing fingers, toes, elbows, everything he could, that that it would start to rain again. Unfortunately for him, it did not. And once the track started drying out, everybody else started to lap faster and faster, and he just started going backwards. Jonas Folger, the German rider who scored his first podium at Indy, just immediately after changing to the Aspar team, was very, very strong at the beginning of the race, despite being on slicks, and basically taking chances because doesn't have as much to lose, I guess. And so he pulled out a massive, massive lead that never actually dwindled. And it made the Moto3 race seem a little bit less exciting than usual, because we knew there was a rider up front. But because the battle between Vinales, Cortese, Salom, Carradine was in there for a while, was so excellent, Danny Kent, was so good that it was still a very enjoyable race to watch. So Folger won. They never did end up catching him, and he won by a full 6 seconds from Luis Salom. And then Sandro Cortese was third, with Maverick Vinales fourth. So once again, Sandro gained a couple points on Vinales in a very crucial race, because we're starting to now get into the later part of the season. I think there's 6 rounds left, so 150 points left on the table. And now Sandro Cortese exactly 200 points. So he's 32 points ahead of Maverick Vinales at 168. And Luis Salom is at 149 now, because he's finished in front of Vinales twice. And this is the second time now that we've had two Germans on the podium. And I actually asked Dr. Martin Raines, when we were at Indy, when was the last time that we had two Germans on the podium in the GP? And he had to go back all the way to 1995 at Le Mans, with Dr. Raines responded to me about this, and it was a bunch of Germans.
Funny.
So yeah, as I mentioned, Efraim Vazquez was on a wet. He led the race. He ended up finishing 25th. So obviously that strategy did not pay off for him. He's definitely an all or nothing guy. You know, when he finishes up front, it's because he managed somehow not to crash.
Mm-hmm.
Carradine was fighting at the front, but then went backwards, and then he tried to catch up with the leaders and crashed. And not a bad ride for Jakob Kornfeld, who's the local favorite, finished sixth. So, yeah, good Moto3 race. Obviously, we've had better races this year, but still nothing to complain about. I think that Vinales really has to... I mean, it's going to be really hard, because there's 154 points left, but he has never really forced Cortese into an error. He has never really beaten Cortese by a large, large chunk of points. So it's going to be rough. It's going to be tough. That German definitely is consistent and aggressive. A very good rider.
True.
Moto2 qualifying, Paul Espargaro on pole again, like an Indy, with Thomas Luthi and Scott Redding on the front row. Marc Marquez was behind Paul on the second row, alongside with Simone Corsi and Andrea Iannone, who has won here, I believe, at least once.
Mm.
I know. He was leading the race that I was at Brno in 2010, and then had a mechanical failure, and that allowed Tony Elias to win. Elias to win. So it looked like Luthi was just going to control the race. He took to the front pretty early on. Scott Redding crashed out on maybe the fifth corner of the race, unfortunately, which is a shame, because he was on the front row, like I mentioned. And but Luthi was basically, I think, leading for the first 12 laps before Marquez finally was able to pass him. And then Espargaro and Iannone all kind of... I don't think Paul led at all. Iannone had short moments where he got into the front ahead of Luthi just for like maybe a corner or two. But it was really a Luthi Marquez show with those guys behind him. And then Paul, about halfway through the race, realized, okay, this is not going well according to plan. This is the second time I've been on pole and I'm behind Marquez. I got to get some points back. He started to push it. Unfortunately, just as he was passing Iannone, there was a crash of a guy that they were about to lap. And so there were yellow flags flying at the corner that he started. So he passed Iannone under the yellow flag. And what's worse is he then got past Marquez. So he got a marker saying, you know, you got to go back one position. But the reality was he actually, by the time he saw the marker, he had to go back two.
That's always a tight situation because a lot of it depends on the TV angle too. You can't really tell where the flag was thrown from.
Well, they did a bunch of replays to show that he was looking through the corner and there was no way for him to see this flag.
Mm.
You know, but it doesn't matter because the flag is flying and he's passing. So whether he sees it or not is not really relevant because at the entry to that corner, the flag was already flying.
Yeah.
I believe that's the way the rule is stated. Anyway, so, but lucky for him, so he did give up the spot to Marquez, but lucky for him, he then got passed by Iannone before he got black flagged.
Nice.
And it didn't look like it was, like he let Iannone through because I think he was pretty much, okay, I went back to the place that I wanted to go, that I was supposed to go back. But you know, did in favor of passing him back. But
picture that. I don't know, passing somebody back out of spite.
Yeah. But in the meantime, they lost touch with the leaders by just about a half a second, but they could never quite gain it. The pace was just, I think, pretty much on the edge. I just say I'm really impressed with Luthi when he rides like this because he's precise and he's very, very hard to pass because he immediately attacks back. Not what I remember when he won the 125 crown. I think he was very not much of a fighter. Where this year he's definitely taking the fight back to Marquez especially. I think probably because of Qatar.
So
anyway,
so Luthi is precise like a Swiss watch.
Yeah. Except you know, the Swiss are neutral. Where he definitely isn't neutral.
Two excellent alliterations in a row.
Anyway, Marquez did get to the front, and then they switched a couple of times, and when they went up the hill, it looked like Luthi had a plan, and blew it. So they went up the final hill, went to the final two corners, and Marquez, with his superior way of exiting the corners, was able to maintain his lead and won by 0.06 of a second. So good race. Paul Espargaró took third, but he did not look happy on the podium. I think he was confused about the flag thing, but most importantly, he lost 9 more points to Marquez, and now Marc Marquez on 213 points. Paul Espargaró on 165. That's 48 points. 48 points is a lot. 48 points is almost two complete wins.
Right. With
six races to go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're going to graduate to a factory team based on the Marquez anti-rules,
right,
you might as well do it in style. And he's certainly doing so. I mean, what are you going to say?
Yeah, I know. He's quite a revelation.
Yeah,
I'm pulling for Paul because I think that because I like him.
Yeah,
seems like a really genuinely fun character.
Well, frankly, the brothers bring a refreshing spirit to the.
Yeah, that's true. I think the fact that they are brothers and the fact that they're always in each other's pits, you know, with the full blown emotions.
Yeah,
it's awesome. Yeah,
totally
awesome to watch. And then we go to MotoGP, the main event.
Well, I do want to point out before we even get into qualifying.
Yes.
Well, okay, get into qualifying first, and then I'll point something out.
Okay. Oh, and I did want to mention that. Never mind. Fuck it. So we had Jorge Lorenzo take pole with Cal Crutchlow as his the runner-up, and Danny Pedrosa as the third guy on the front row, and then Spies, Dovizioso, and Valentino Rossi in his best qualifying for the year, or matching, I think.
Yep.
Bradle, Bautista, Harley Abraham in front of his dad and friends. Rene Dupuis, Aleix Espargaró, Yanni Hernandez, and then Tony Elias, the 13th. I'll never get that right. Michelle Pirro, Colin Edwards, Pacini, Ellison, Silva, and Petrucci. What were you going to point out?
Ben Spies won qualifying or warm up.
He won warm up?
Yes.
So what did he get?
I know that? You don't get a trophy or anything for it, but he did win warm up.
Yeah, yeah. No, he looked actually his pace all weekend was looking strong. He was extremely excited to get into the race, and for good reason because he had a great pace at Indy as well. So it was like, you know,
this was another weekend where we're like, all right,
finally Ben's going to do well.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, the fact that we knew when we were watching warm up. That the weather was going to be probably not the same. It was mixed conditions, started off quite wet, and then dried out a bit as time went on. But it was pretty clear that wasn't going to be the way for the race, but it was still kind of heartening to see that he had that kind of pace, and he pipped it on the last lap, didn't he, in warm-up? Did you get it?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I did watch it. I'm pretty sure he got it right on the last lap. In fact, he was the last bike through right after Jorge, who took it, and it was like 2 seconds later. So,
yeah, but you know what? That's the thing that kind of a one lap thing can throw people off because both the poles that Paul Espargaró got
nice.
Both at Indy and Brno were one laps. You know, single fantastic laps, whereas the rest of his laps were a little bit slower than Marquez. So it presented a confusing picture, not a confusing picture, but a misleading picture. But to see him on pole both races. But that's always like that.
But at the same time, he is second in points.
No. I'm of course. I mean, Espargaró is amazing. He's won races too. I'm just saying I don't go by warm up. I go by.
I know.
Practice times
I said in a very joking manner.
Got it.
Right. There are no Rolexes, no BMWs for winning warm up. But that being said, we did celebrate quite handily when Josh Hayes won the warm up last week.
Exactly. I was just going to say that was one that for the record book.
Yeah.
And Jorge, by the way, looked super strong. This has always been a very good track to Yamaha, and so actually, what happened in the race was extra special because of that, because when the race started, Jorge got the hole shot from Danny Pedrosa. So I was already thinking like, okay, well, what's third going to look like?
And you're going to have to redo the opening soundtrack this week. It doesn't fit.
I do that every week because it's always for that round.
Does anybody notice, Jules, you think?
I don't know. I hope Dorna doesn't.
waving quietly. Hi, Dorna.
Hi. Yeah. All right. So, so like I said, Jorge did get the whole shot into turn one, and then Danny lined up behind him. And then it was Ben Spies, and Valentino Rossi got a good start. He was fifth probably because Cal was up there at WWE.
He got a damn good start. I was very impressed.
Yeah, and then we had that weird puff of smoke come out of Rossi's bike, and then at the same time, Ben Spies started to fall back through the ranks, and so there was some confusion as to maybe that he saw the smoke from Rossi's bike, thought that there was oil on the ground. Then there was way that maybe the smoke actually came out of Ben's bike.
But it was pretty clear the way that he pulled over. I mean, the timing, yes. Rossi was in front of him when the smoke came out, and it was a serious puff.
Yeah.
But he was far enough behind Rossi where it was, at least to me, unless...
I know. It definitely looked like it came out of a bike ahead of Spies.
But the way Ben pulled his hand up and the way he was looking down at his bars when he did it, it was pretty clear that he knew that he had a control problem with his bike as opposed to a major engine problem, to me.
Right, but what I thought what happened was that the Rossi's engine actually blew, and that there was oil on the track, and that's what Ben hit, and that's why he was like, whoa, you know. Didn't turn out to be the case, because what actually happened was two completely separate incidents. They had nothing to do with each other. Rossi's bike was, it's his, basically, I think, the last race on that particular engine.
Oh, I hope so.
And his, as they explained later, it was his transmission that was just basically grinding gears. And what you saw was the end of life of that engine. Well, it did bring him home, but... I think this is something that I'm not sure why, just because you don't lay oil on a track, you should still get black flagged for puffing smoke into riders' faces.
Perhaps it was the final hurrah for Marlboro being on Ducati.
Nice. Anyway, so what happened to Ben was he actually had a problem with his clutch. It seemed to have overheated. They went over the data later and found that there was absolutely nothing different or unusual that he did or that the bike did. But you know, this is going back to the email from Rogerio about rider number one, number two, and all the different parts. It may have been exactly the same kind of clutch, the same exact even batch that they were making. It may have been the exact same material, everything that was in both Jorge's clutch and in Ben's previous clutches, but it just failed, you know? Yep. Something went wrong. Some sensor screwed up, some piece of code didn't act the way it was supposed to, and the clutch overheated, and he fell back, I think, to like 13th place at one point.
Yeah, 14th, and fine, blame us.
14th. That's crazy. Then he tried to once everything started working correctly, he tried to make up the positions, and either because the bike was not 100% yet, or simply because he was pushing it to try to get back with the leaders, unfortunately he crashed.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that the bike at that point was functioning quite well, because he was running lap times that were about a second off the guys at the very front, or a second and a half.
Yep.
But he was weaving his way through the last of the CRT boys. And once he got a whole bunch of open track, and he said it himself, he was pushing to get back up to the, I think it was Rossi that was next to
Rossi Battle Bautista.
And
yeah.
He just pushed it too hard, he said. So, you know, and that, you got to give him that. Shit mechanical luck, self acceptance of a mistake made in a race, obviously frustration and not happy because both happened. But he took responsibility for part two, not part one, I'm sure. But, I don't know, you know, what do you do? But the race continued, and it, you know, it, we got a bit of a quiet time in there in the middle, although with a whole bunch of anticipation, up at the front. But it certainly was going to wind out at the end with quite a bit of surprise.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if it was as much a surprise as okay. So this, I think the surprise was that Danny Pedrosa didn't fade.
Yeah.
Jorge was leading, Danny was following, and then just around the time where most of us, I think, started saying, well, yeah, you know, of course he's going to follow him this far, but after this, you know, but then he's going to start to drop off in typical Danny manner. Well, that's exactly when Danny actually passed Lorenzo, and suddenly it got really interesting, because now the roles got reversed. Cal was kind of keeping them in sight, but slowly losing a second, 10th of a second here, 10th of a second there.
But Cal was keeping the pace very wisely ahead of Dovi. Yeah.
He was keeping, that's the guy he was keeping track of much more than the guys in front who he could still see,
right?
You know? And then Jorge was behind Danny, and again, you start thinking, you know, it's Jerez 2010, I think, when Lorenzo caught and passed Danny on the last lap. You know, it's just, he's just playing the waiting game kind of thing. Well, when we get to the final couple laps, it turned out that that was definitely not the case. I think they were both pretty much on the edge of what they could do. Lorenzo tried a couple of places, a couple of rehearsals, I guess, but really he was just trying to pass Danny. Didn't work.
Yeah, Danny turned, I was trying to think of a metaphor. Danny turned into like a mosquito, you know, one of those things that just keeps buzzing around you, into a bit more of like when you see a blue jay go after a hawk, you know, dive bombing them. But with
blue jays after hawks?
You're not up in the hills enough. But yes, oh, that does happen.
Really?
Yes, it does.
Nice.
But with absolute control and professionalism. I mean, he wasn't poking
throwing it in there.
Yeah, he wasn't throwing it in, but you knew that the last couple of laps were going to be a damn good race.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. Both riders, Jorge obviously made a little bit of a mistake at the very, very end, but it wasn't actually, I don't even call it a mistake, but what surprised me about Danny was that usually he gets out of the way when he thinks he's going to get bashed into.
Yep.
Where he just basically just kept to his line. He's like, okay, this is the line I'm taking through it. I don't freaking care what Jorge does. This is the line I'm taking. And that made it really tough on Jorge because he was the one that had to have to be more aggressive. And I think that's why the race ended the way it did, because up the hill, Jorge knew that Danny would have the advantage. And at the end of the straight, so here's the thing about, you know, we were talking about the M1 earlier, about Sam when Sam Dixon wrote in about how good the M1 is. Well, the M1 in everybody's hands is really good on the brakes. You know, the Vizioso has done magic with that thing on the brakes. Rossi, when he was racing that thing, was magic on the brakes.
I'd just be so-so.
Yeah. So we would get to the end of the straight, and Danny clearly had the pace to catch Lorenzo if they just had, you know, 10 more meters. But once they hit those brakes, it was definitely the Yamaha that had the advantage, right? So every time there was a situation when there was power and then a braking situation, Jorge would get the advantage. Well, up the hill, you don't get that as much because they call it horsepower hill for a reason. So the Honda does have that slight advantage, and I think Jorge basically said, okay, well, I know what I'm going to do. At the top of the hill, I'm just going to use my advantage with the brakes. And unfortunately, I don't think it was a mistake. I think it was just he did not expect Danny to, once again, just stick to his line.
Well, let's back it up, like, I don't know, two or three corners, Jules, because one of the best passes that we've had all year.
When Jorge went under Danny,
that was not a no room pass, but the absolute minimum amount of space you would need to do it
there
may have been a brush or something like that, but yeah. It wasn't anything that affected either of the riders. Danny did have to stand it up a little bit wisely. But that was probably, I've seen the one blow up photo of that, and I'm sure there's many more. I don't think I've quite seen lean angle like that in a long time.
Jorge, especially that session, because they're starting to go up the hill. It's the transition.
Yeah. If I hear the term the world's largest dino again, I think I'm going to go nuts, but it is kind of a good point. And interestingly enough, Berno is a track, and you know, we watch these races race in and race out. It is a track that really illustrates the difference between the Honda and the Yamaha. And certainly, as you said, the kind of the last ditch effort that Jorge made to go, and bravely enough made to go around the outside on Danny on the second to last corner before they got on the straight. He didn't crash, which I really thought he was going to. he went as wide as he could out into, if that had happened at Indy, sorry to say, but with all the marbles that were out there, he probably would have gone down or gone in the grass. The track was clean mainly because of all the rain that had come through as the weekend had gone on. To have him actually get kind of back online, but totally lost the drive and still actually, because I don't think Danny took the LDL line through that second last corner. I almost thought there might be a battle to line, but you knew that Honda, if it was marginally ahead, heading to the finish line, was going to win.
Right. Yeah. Right. And which is what happened.
Yeah, which is what happened.
But I do want to point out, because I've heard the race win described kind of like this, where, you know, Jorge did everything possible, but the Honda was better up the hill. So, yes, absolutely, Honda is better in a straight line, and the application of that by Danny Pedrosa makes it even more so. And both him and Stoner have really mastered the corner exit on that machine. But, you know, the Yamaha is better in corners. And because you're cornering, and I've heard this argument, I've made this argument before when I was, you know, talking about my boy Rossi, when he was my boy. You know, but, you know, it's in the corners that you win races and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, if you have a bike that the corner is better, then if, you know, then give credit where credit is due. I mean, if you're going to talk about the Honda beating Jorge up the hill, then you got to talk about the Yamaha beating Danny through the corners.
I think people did. I mean, I think that.
I know that the commentators say that, but I never hear people say, well, the Yamaha beat Danny through a corner, but you will definitely hear people say the Honda beat Jorge up the hill.
You have to travel in better circles.
Okay.
But I mean,
my point is that both bikes have their advantages.
Sure.
And these two riders took advantage of those advantages.
Yeah, they exploited
very well throughout the entire race.
They exploited what they had at their hands at the time. I mean, even Jorge was saying, and you could actually see it during the race, having known what he said when I got a chance to watch it, that he was having some braking problems. You could actually see him push the front a bunch of times, but the way that he was doing it, I think he actually knew that he was going to push the front on some of the laps he was running, because he and Danny were running some very competitive lap times, and they slowed down. It really was not even a cat and mouse game. It was a cooperative race for part of it, where they were both just making laps, making sure that and this is something that we don't see that often, and something that's a bit more mature from the two of them is that. And it might bore some people because they're when guys get out front and they manage a race, the two people manage a race at the front. And so they know that the pace they want to run. And so, and they're far enough ahead. They don't have to worry about Cal. They don't have to worry about anybody else. And so they'll run, you know, a 56, they'll run a 52, exaggeration there, but you could actually see it at the laps that they were running really quick, where Danny or Jorge were trying to break away, neither of which could. That when Jorge was in front, he got in the corners too hot, and it was kind of clear there was a braking issue because you could see him completely push the front into a couple of corners. To me, pushing the front is like being 6 inches offline, and have to pull it back again. But the way that he was taking the corners and the late entry that he was doing was making sure that Danny didn't have the line to get him in the slow parts of the track.
Right. And there was definitely some great when Jorge put that first pass on Danny earlier in that those final laps. Not only did he pass him, but the way he positioned his exit of that pass was brilliant because he just left Danny nothing. And then Danny repaid the favor because he was doing the same. You know, he was riding the ideal line, not for, not necessarily just for his own speed, but also to make sure that Jorge couldn't get through. You know, let's let's just summarize it this way. It was a fucking great race.
It was.
It was really fucking good.
It was like an Oreo turned inside out. So it had the creamy filling on the outside and kind of the cookie crunch on the inside, where you were like, all right, let's see. I can understand the people that said it was kind of a boring race in the middle. Not boring, if you will, but you kind of thought that it might be one of those processional ones. But the end was certainly fantastic. Jules, there wasn't a lot of passing. People kind of demand that these days. I do want to say that it was absolutely brilliant to have Cal on the podium. And I don't think I've seen a rider as happy in a long time. And
let's face it, almost every commentator that we listen to is British. So that also made it even more interesting, because there were I wanted to cry.
Well, yeah, no. In having known the results before the race, I watched everything through the end because I wanted to see his reaction. And he was way stoked. And having talked to him at Indy, I mean, and talked to him at Laguna, I mean, it's just, I'm stoked for him. So,
yeah, I mean, he's a super cool guy. And, you know, when was the last time a Brit stood on the podium?
In 2000.
In top class? It was, what's his name?
McWilliams.
McWilliams, of course. Yep. McWilliams holds all the last Brit
yes,
records. Yeah. Also, I think most of the last two-stroke records. So 13 points now separate Danny Pedrosa and Lorenzo. We've got a championship. We've got a serious freaking championship fight. And Jorge is, you know, looking still very confident, but I think that there's a chink in his armor now. He's like, shit.
Yeah.
This was the Yamaha track and Honda beat me. Yeah. What's going to happen when we get to, let's say, I was going to say Sepang, but Sepang has a mixed history.
I think it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because the bikes have evolved. And I think that as long as Danny Pedrosa stays healthy and Jorge stays healthy, we're going to have a great championship for the rest of the season.
I think so. But at the same time, there are tracks as we go through the rest of the season that the Hondas and the Yamahas are strong at. And don't forget, we shouldn't forget, at least for the meantime. Okay, so now we've got Johnny Ray probably is going to run on the Repsol.
He's going to be sitting in for Stoner.
Yeah, he'll be sitting in for Stoner.
At Misano, at least.
I did say to you, Jules, I still want to come back to this. Remember what I said, presciently, maybe, that Stoner would be back at PI, even before that he ended up racing at Indy. That might be a bit of a wild card in more than one way, if you will, because he's got a bike that's capable of running up front. He ran the ninth fastest time in the test, and we'll talk about the test in a bit, but that should be interesting. I mean, you know, frankly, it's a race winning bike, clearly, with a guy on it that's doesn't have a lot to lose.
Yeah, especially considering what happened in Moscow.
You know, there's very divided opinion on that too.
Yeah.
Amongst journalists and the public, so we could go in that in depth. We probably will.
The other thing I wanted to mention was that given that both Brattle and Bautista got past Rossi, who was actually looking like he may be able to catch Dovi, but that just was not the case. It really looks like at this point Valentino Rossi is going to probably finish seventh or eighth in the championship, which is where he finished eighth last year. Well, he tied for seventh with Simoncelli, but if Simoncelli not passed away at Sepang, I'm sure that he would have been behind him. So I think that the reason why I wanted to mention it is because it's got to be with now. Well, you know, Ross is an actor, so a lot of the things he said at India Laguna were just his usual playmaking, where he was talking about, well, I'm going to have to see whether I'm still good enough, you know. But it has to be very demoralizing to know that it's another 2 years basically have gone down, and they were by far his worst years, and now he has to go and, you know, at he's going to be 34, 35 actually, no, 34. You know, he's going to be with a championship contender on a bike that may be a little bit different than what he's used to riding. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see that whole switch to Yamaha for Rossi, because I think that you have to be, even a superhuman is going to be demoralized to some degree.
Well, yeah.
You could see it. You could see it in the way he rides during some of the races. When he feels really good, you can see he's enjoying himself. And when he's not enjoying himself, you could definitely tell as well. And I think most of the last 2 years, we have not seen him enjoying himself except for like two or three races.
A tiny little clue that I can have about how confident he is when he's on the bike and racing or qualifying, is you remember the way that he nearly almost, it seemed like he was looking straight down when he'd be in a corner.
Oh yeah.
And he'd be like watching the edge of the curbing, and you see him sitting up just a little bit more and looking farther ahead when he's not feeling confident. But I would have to say that this last weekend in Brno, there were times before his tire went off where he had the look of the old Rossi.
Yeah, totally. No, he looked like he was going to catch Dovi and give a good fight for fourth.
Yep, but I mean, I think he knew straight up. Okay, and so here's something that was very interesting about last weekend's races. This was the first time the whole year that everybody on the grid was running the same tire combinations.
Really? Even Ilias?
Even Ilias. Yeah.
Huh.
Or Elias.
Elias.
Tony. same time this year. There was same race this year that everybody on the grid was running the exact same tire combo.
Interesting. I didn't catch that.
Yep. According to Bridgestone, it was because the temperatures were much cooler than last year. And so they were able to do that. Now, the tire combo was, I believe, the hard front, which doesn't warm up so fast, but the soft rear, you saw those white stripes, right? On the rear tires. And that was the deal there. So hard fronts, soft rears for everybody, and nobody's, you saw the tires in Parc Fermé, everybody's tires look great. So it seemed to work out, but it was pretty clear that the one thing that we've seen all year in the times that he gets to do it, and they talked about this on Eurosport, is that Valentino's having to basically turn the bike from the rear when the tire goes off. And so that's when he backs off.
Yep. He's not a rear guy.
No.
All right. So, excellent race. You know, Stoner's, even if he came back in the next round, his championship hopes are gone. Because both, there's two guys now that have moved way ahead of him in points. And like I said, I'm crossing my fingers that Danny stays healthy, because this could be a cracker. To the finish line, to Valencia.
Yeah. No, totally.
And I really, by the way, I totally agree with this next note.
What's that?
Talk about next week.
Yeah, well, if we stop the test.
Why don't we do a two-parter? So we will complete this show with MotoGP test.
Yes.
And we'll do Eastern Europe part one this week and Eastern Europe part two next week.
I agree. Because, and then those of you that haven't sent us in feedback about Moscow World Superbike, feel free to do so. Yeah. But I do want to talk about the test a bit, because it was kind of interesting.
There were actually two tests.
There were.
Two separate tests.
Well, I think as we type, are they in Aragon right now, or is that next week?
No, I mean, I'm just saying that Rossi went to Misano to test.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so
at the same time, there was the usual test that Brno has on the Monday after the race, and there was also the test at Misano for Ducati.
Which so they flew Jonathan Rayan to ride on Stoner's bike.
Yep,
and he got comfortable with it pretty quick, ran decent times. Loris Caparossi, as the safety officer, was out there, rode four bikes.
yeah, you know, I got to go check out the safety on these bikes.
Yeah, no kidding. Although
that's a job you got to hate.
I have to admit, I think he did it the right way. He wanted to ride Yamaha. There was some issue where he couldn't. He got to ride Stoner's Honda or somebody's Honda. And three of the CRT bikes, the NGM Forward, I think one of the ARTs, maybe Depuniers, and the Iota, I want to say. I could be wrong on that. Sorry, Loris. He came away with a lot of praise for the CRTs. And the first thought that went through my head is, you haven't ridden in a while, have you? But regardless of that, the one thing he really came away with praise was for the Bridgestones, and especially the warm-up characteristics. So apparently they've got that going right. Now, we were complaining not so long ago about the Bridgestones. Where? Laguna? Somewhere? But they...
Well, I mean, that's the big story here is that he was so down on Bridgestone,
yep.
You know, yep. Last year when he was still racing, and like he vowed one of the first things he was going to do as a safety is to manage the tires,
right?
You know, and so it's good to see him happy. I think he spent like a couple hours at Clinica Mobile getting a smile taken off his face.
true. Now the Bridgestone did bring out some new compound tires. They were, I guess, they were what did they say? I was just trying to remember this off the top of my head, but they were. In the hard carcass, it was a more medium compound. So something that would, I don't know, technically I don't know how you can break that down. But there were three guys that used them because the temperatures were still too low for them to be ideal for testing. And so what they were going to do is give them to the guys that were going to be testing later in the week. And I thought it was interesting, and I think that is our Aragon, Jules. It's going to be Honda and Yamaha, and we're going to be the only two teams that were there and the only ones that get to test the tires for next year.
Hmm.
Other things of note?
Wait, hang on a second. So
yeah.
Ducati at Misano did not get that same new compound?
No, not to test.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought they were testing something new with the tires, too. I know that they were testing a whole bunch of bits.
And Bob...
Yeah, no, literally that's what they said.
Okay.
Basically everything except electronics and engines, so nothing exciting. But I thought that they threw a new tire on there.
They could have. You never know if they checked them one under the gate. not that they necessarily do that so much anymore. Although I wouldn't be surprised if they did. Of one thing that totally flew under the radar to everybody. It was that Jorge tested the first iteration to be seen in public of the 2013 M1.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in black carbon trim with a red, you know, number on it. So that's kind of a first. And that's certainly the first announced 2013. Now, you know what? It could have been a 2012 with the black carbon.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean... But because Honda did that last year, remember Honda,
yeah.
Honda and Suzuki a couple of years ago ran their next year's model like really early in the season to start getting ready. I think actually that was during the transition to the 800s. So that kind of made more sense.
True.
So
I was looking at the pictures that were provided both by MotoGP.com and by Yamaha trying to spot any visual differences. I couldn't spot anything that really stood out at me, even blowing them up big time. So,
well, there was a giant rocket engine on the back of it.
Yeah, and a nitrous oxide bottle hanging.
Right. Yeah.
No, and so you know they didn't have any sounds. They didn't have any video. Of course, I wouldn't either.
Yep.
I'm sure there were teams out there with recorders and all that, but it was still kind of cool. The other thing is. Mentioned Ray came in ninth, and Brundle had a great run. And you know, one of the things that I was thinking about when I was talking to Lucio was even before that we knew that Casey was not going to be appearing. Is there a possibility that Brundle might end up with a factory engine? Well, if you're going to take an up and coming rider, and Ray is going to be in there, do you want to risk the factory bike with Ray on it, or do you want to clothe that in the LCR colors?
Mm. But then what about Bautista? He was like 5/1000ths behind Brattle.
Well, Brattle is kind of the satellite hopeful for Honda.
No, I know, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't think they gave Brattle the goods yet.
Yet.
Yeah. No, I think the most awesome thing that could happen next year is if Marquez came into the Repsol team and Brattle got, well, we know it was just happening, but Brattle got a factorish machine.
Factor-ish. I like
factor-ish.
That.
Factor-ish, yes.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that, it's beyond the pale. Okay, so here's an interesting what if, because this what if is coming up imminently. What if Ray comes in and does well?
Well, we'll see. I mean, Jonathan Ray has oodles of talent.
Is that a technical term?
Yeah. And I don't see why he would do shitty. But, I'm going to give him a sixth at Misano.
Yeah, I think that's generous, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it all depends on how much his attitude is winner to Bennett. Or
the attitude of Honda saying, listen,
don't
go out there, yeah. get used to it, because one day you might be riding one of these things for a whole entire season. But if you crash, you will not be riding this thing for an entire season.
Or ever.
Yeah. Ever.
So it
depends on a lot of stuff, of course. And his condition from any superbike related stuff.
True. The interesting thing about the races that are coming up, for the most part, is there's no conflicts for a bit. So
yeah,
it does give him the opportunity to bounce back and forth. The physical divide between races is going to be a bitch. But he's a kid. I say that in the nicest of ways. So I really actually do like the idea of moving the Moscow round out to next week. It'll give me more of a chance to, well, let's say actually watch the races and analyze some of the stuff that's coming out of it, because with Ray,
so much got turned upside down in Moscow. And it's worth talking about, definitely. And we're not going to be able to get to it tonight. It's past midnight, and we got to put this thing in the can.
Yeah, I agree.
Don't forget to check out the LCR Inspire magazine.
Yes.
Join us on Facebook. Once again, you don't have to sign up. You can just go look at the pretty pictures and things we have to say, and then you can't respond because you're not signed up.
But
don't forget, we have an email address. We have a I know what I really, really forgot to mention last time. I really wanted to mention this time. Simon Roberts, who's been building our website for many, many years now, is working on a new version of our website with me a little bit. I mean, that meaning I'm just looking at stuff going, yeah, that looks good. And he's just been kicking ass. I don't know if you guys have noticed, there's now a Flickr stream of photos under every show that's automatically generated based on the show notes. And from my Flickr stream for the photos that I've taken at the various rounds. So definitely visit the website. And Simon, thank you so much. I asked him, like, what can we do for you, dude? You know, is there anything we can do for you? He's like, I'm a fan. So it's so cool that he's been helping us out, I think, since maybe 2006 or 2007.
I think
many years.
Let me help you out here, Jules, because lots of people get this from iTunes. The website you want to go to, folks,
that's right,
would be www.motopodcast.com, and you can see all the cool stuff that Simon's been putting together for us.
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
Just to help.
Yep. Go check it out. And so huge thanks to him for all the work, especially lately. He's been driving that kind of on his own. He's been just taking the initiative and saying, okay, well, we need to move, we need to make this site refresh, give it a refresher.
I actually like the initiative that he's doing, and kind of he'll just go, all right, I'm going to do this and see what they think.
Right.
Yeah, I'm good with that. Thank you, Simon.
And now, Jim, do your exit spiel.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, thank you so much for listening. Way cool. All of you that have donated, this particular week has been extra special because we've got some serious bills to pay.
We didn't actually go through the donators. Did you realize that?
Yeah, we did.
No, we didn't.
Oh, we didn't? Okay, hang on. No. All right. I'm sorry we left you to the end of the show, but you guys are all actually real friends of the show. People that we met face to face. Super freaking cool friends of the show. Damn it. Sorry to leave you to the end, but actually sometimes the best things comes last. Andrew Cole, Darren Moore, Paul Henderson, and our mascot, Christina Sua.
Oh, man.
She's going to kill me for that.
Oh, boy.
Thank you, all of you, so much. Seriously, this was actually really helpful because we had some bills to pay and we still have some bills to pay. And so way, way cool. Jules and I have been working night and day. I've been working overtime. So have you, dude, to try and get some of this stuff covered in our real jobs. So awesome. Thank you so much. You know, I knew I meant to go back to the Jules, but we never did. To finish this out. Thank you once again. If you'd like to donate to the show, and did I mention it's really cool when you do, you can do so through the Facebook fan page. You can do it through www.motopodcast.com. Look for the donate link on the left-hand side. You can write into us to give us feedback on the show to motopod@motopodcast.com. You can do it through the website. Or through the Facebook fan page, or if you find us on the street, or send us snail mail, we're all good with that. Jules, I think we've rambled on. I think both of you and I are tired, and we should probably put this dog to bed. I'm actually kind of stoked that we'll talk about World Superbike next week. I'm not sure who's going to be on the show. Maybe Martin may rejoin us for something.
Oh, yeah, we should actually mention, you know, Martin's done with his walk, right?
Yeah, we don't have to hear about it. Well, no, we'll have to hear about his feet next week if he's on the show, won't we?
Ugh, God.
You got this one covered, right? We will talk to you guys next week. We'll talk to you through Facebook. We'll talk to you anywhere we want to and you would like to do so. Look forward to everything. And Jules, I think it's time not for us to go to bed, but for us individually to nod off. Thanks so much, folks.
Okay. Ciao.
Good night.